Good morning. This is At Issue on WGXC 90.7 FM and WGXC.org. This is At Issue, and we are with Parry Teasdale, who is the publisher of the Columbia paper, and we're going to be talking a little bit about the recent scandals on the state level. My co-hosts are
Deborah Gilbert
and Debbie Mayer.
For full disclosure, since we're talking about Democratic politics or politics in general, I'm Victor Mandolia, and I am the chair of the Hudson City Democratic Committee. Debbie Mayer is a member of the Hudson City Democratic Committee, and Deborah Gilbert is a former Democratic town board member in the town of Taconic. So thank you for joining us today, Parry. For our listeners, we'll just say that we're recording this one day in advance, in case there's any breaking news that happens tomorrow. But you've been doing a lot of research on the arrest of Sheldon Silver, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about your thoughts on that.
We hear you read all 35 pages of the complaint, and is that available online?
It's available online. I got it through a link from the Times Union website and in Albany, the Albany newspaper, and I believe it's still there. It's mounted by a separate entity, and so it's public information, and you can get it. It makes for, I thought, interesting reading for anybody who's interested in how the money side of Albany works and why the Speaker of the State Assembly was arrested by federal agents a couple of weeks ago.
Was he arrested?
He was arrested. He was brought into, actually probably surrendered at, I don't know, I assume it's the court, federal court in New York City. In any case, it was in New York City. And he was charged this. What there is a... information. It's not an indictment.
It wasn't an indictment.
No, it is an indictment. It's a criminal complaint.
Yeah.
So, in other words, on that basis, they can arrest him and charge him with that crime. He's charged with it, but that doesn't mean that an indictment will necessarily follow with exactly the same, as far as I understand the legal system. But I don't want to actually offer any sort of expert advice on that because I don't know. But that's what happened, and I think it's sometimes called, or it may be an information, as strangely enough, an odd way of using that term for lay people. But basically, it lays out by an investigator working with the federal attorney's office for the Southern District of the State of New York, and that would be Preet Bharara, and it lays out all the charges and the information that they have that led to these charges and how it was obtained and the qualifications of the investigator to be making these charges, so that this is the grounds for the arrest. And among the things that are in that information and that document, that is a chart of how the money was allocated to Speaker Silver. And that chart was quite informative. And if you have that chart, you know, it's been reproduced in other ways, but it's part of the case against him. And that, in a way, lays it out rather... No, this you're pointing to a graphic that was created by the Times Union, but this is an actual chart year by year of the amount of money that Sheldon Silver received from about 2002 to 2014.
So an Excel chart or spreadsheet?
No, it's just a form, and they list where roughly the money came from, and Sheldon Silver was making a speaker, and in an hour and 15 minutes, he will no longer be the speaker.
Right.
As we talk Tuesday,
yes.
And a new speaker will be elected immediately by acclamation of the Assembly Democrats. That's what was being said yesterday.
That's the plan.
Yeah. Whether or not that will actually happen, I can't imagine it won't happen, frankly.
Yeah.
But that's something else we can talk about. But what it shows and is remarkable, I could bring it up online and anybody can look at it, is that the speaker was making $120,000 roughly from the state. He gets a $50,000 or 70-something thousand. The actual numbers escape me at the moment. But salary, that's what every legislator, every assembly member gets. And then after that, he was getting some money for being speaker,
right,
which
right.
$40,000 or whatever it was. So right. he was making roughly $120,000 a year, and he was being paid by a law firm, a personal injury law firm in New York City, a retainer, I guess you would call it, or a fee of some kind, of an additional $120,000. It was kind of going along in that area, and then long about the mid 2000s, it jumped from somewhere in the neighborhood of that $120,000 to $600,000. And then it just kept growing and growing and growing. And
this is Weitz and Luxembourg, right?
Yeah, Weitz and Luxembourg.
Many people may be familiar with their television commercials, their big personal injury.
Big personal injury. And then, of course, what is also contained besides the chart is what those figures represent in terms of how the money was being made. And at first blush, you think, well, wait a minute, this is prosecutorial overreach, because why, you know, everybody does it, and certainly Sheldon Silver would know the rules because he'd written most of the rules for the state, not the federal ones, obviously, but the state. And one of the things that was happening, and only one of them, but it's related to the firm's business as a personal injury lawsuit, or a firm that handles personal injury cases. He was referring clients to the law firm. And, well, how did he get those clients? Well, the way he was getting the clients was he was very close to a doctor who was doing research in mesothelioma, which is the asbestos-induced cancer or caused cancer. And so there you have that. That seems reasonable. Okay, so he refers them to his law firm, and the doc is doing research, and the doc wants to get something for it. What does the doc want? Well, the doc is, and this is a legitimate physician in the sense that he's doing research and treatment of people with mesothelioma, which is a very deadly disease. And so that's the snowplow going by. Everyone will understand that this right now. Anyway, the doctor was seeking money to do additional research. There aren't a whole lot of people with this disease, but the people who have it really want some help. And one of the things that the speaker has is control over a large pool of money that the state has for medical purposes. And the origins are explained in the document, and I don't want to go into them because, again, I'm no expert in this case. I don't want to present myself as an expert. To say I've done research, I've read the...
You're
read
a journalist.
I'm a journalist. So that's
and you're one of the
different...
few people in the United States who has read the entire complaint,
probably if you say
sure.
the whole United States. But it's been read. You know, I looked last night on that particular document. There were 7,000 hits on the document.
All right,
now, it doesn't mean everybody read it, but that means it drew some traffic.
Yes.
I don't know whether that, you know, I've been on a couple of times,
yeah.
so maybe, I don't know how it counts, whether it sends a cookie and tells you, you know, how many people, but whatever. It has had some traffic. But anyway, the money was controlled by the speaker. In other words, it didn't have to be approved by the legislature or the governor. The speaker could simply say, I'm going to
allocate
this money, and right. lo and behold, the doctor gets the money. Now, the doctor's legitimately getting money from legitimately controlled by the speaker, but the money is going back to one firm. Mm-hmm. The money and the patients are being referred to one firm,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and apparently, when it stopped coming, the doctor started to send it to other firms.
We talked about that. When he ran out of that money, he found another law firm.
He found another law firm. So the other thing is that the investigators tried to contact or did contact the families or the individuals who had the disease. None of them had ever heard of Sheldon Silver or ever seen him.
Mm-hmm.
And he had never made an appearance in court. about these cases.
I see.
Now, in fairness, you have to say that there are a lot of very high-powered lawyers in Washington, in state capitals, other places, who lend their names to things, and that's enough to bring business to a client. Mario
Cuomo,
you know, yeah, the rainmaker, the person who just has the one telephone number and picks up the phone and calls. I mean, Mario Cuomo must have been doing that, and I'm sure in an entirely legal way, when he, after he was governor, went to a lobbying firm. Well, why did they want him? They didn't want him to go to court. They wanted him because he had a Rolodex at the time, this is what people used. He had the names and numbers and could pick up the phone and call people. Or people would come, oh, Mario Cuomo's there. And again, I'm not trying to taint Mario Cuomo's legacy in any way with this. All I'm saying is that it is not unusual for this to happen.
Right.
What was unusual was that there was no record of Sheldon Silver's involvement. And the money that he was doing it, unlike Mario Cuomo, he was doing it while he was a sitting legislator.
Yes.
Legislators are allowed to have a job other than being a legislator, but they're not required to report individually what it is. The federal attorney is saying that a tremendous amount of this money, maybe up to $4 million, was actually hidden and moved around by the speaker. Now, whether that will turn out to be the case, or whether a jury will buy that's fraudulent in some way, who knows? But
one article said he had numerous bank accounts.
Numerous bank accounts. But you know, there might be some reason to have numerous bank accounts because he had numerous different sources of revenue.
Attorneys have numerous bank accounts.
Exactly. The attorneys have all those things. So none of these things by themselves are necessarily indicative of here's the smoking gun, here's that, according to, you know, just a layperson. Now, from the prosecutor's point of view, of course, it's a smoking gun. From the defense attorney's point of view, it's all just bogus and just a witch hunt to get this guy. What struck me, however, was when a lawmaker, and especially the most powerful lawmaker in Albany, because it's the head of the speaker of the assembly is the most powerful in the state of all compared to the Senate or whatever. Just those two bodies, the Senate and the Assembly, because the Assembly is larger, and we can talk about why that matters in a moment. But he's the most powerful lawmaker in Albany, and he all of a sudden his income shoots up. And he's not reporting it. And should the guy take a vow of poverty? No. There's nothing that says he has to do it. Why should he set a higher standard than anybody else just because he's a powerful politician? But to me, in the depths of the recession, for him to be gaining this much money, and it just rubbed me the wrong way. I said, This is just wrong, ethically and morally, even if not legally. And I'm not able to judge anybody legally, and ethically and morally, we all have our failings.
You've said a couple of times though that everybody does it, but everybody doesn't do it. I mean, not everybody who is a legislator has outside income at all. Some are full-time legislators. Others don't take per diems as well. And like our current Dee Dee Barrett, who's the assemblywoman here,
and
she's
that's
a full-time
correct.
Legislator
correct.
And doesn't take per diems at all. So I just think we just want to be clear about that.
And thank you, because that is important, because I don't think we're going to tar the entire legislature with that.
Just maybe most of them.
Well, I think and most of the lawyers, apparently, because by definition, if they're practicing law, they have a second. They have a second source of income.
If you're just joining us, we're with Perry Teasdale, who is the publisher of the Columbia paper, and we're talking about the recent scandal with Sheldon Silver and others coming up on the state level.
So last week you said you read this whole thing and it was depressing. That was your word, depressing.
Well, I think that's how I felt about it, because I had seen Sheldon Silver as kind of a bulwark against some of the more conservative policies of state government that would have cut education funding, that would have cut social spending, that would have really not ins- that didn't ensure women's rights to control their own bodies, you know, in a way that would make it as at least as strong as federal decisions and law. And even though, you know, New York was first in that regard, the laws are outdated here. And so those are kinds of things that Sheldon Silver had championed. And I always thought, well, yeah, he's got a lot of, if not skeletons in the closet, at least he's got ties to the real estate industry. And then there's a whole other area, by the way, of the real estate industry and what was happening there with cases of certiorari, which are tax-related cases, and where he's listed and didn't show up, but he's never listed in court proceedings. But as you kind of go, what you see is this tolerance for and really taking advantage of the lax laws that this state has in particular, that allow you to do these things. And he was exploiting his position, it seemed to me. Again, whether legally exploiting may be the right term. Whether or not they'll get him on those things,
right,
I don't know.
I'm
not sure that you can distinguish from the other people who are doing it. Mm-hmm. And you're right again to say that it's not everybody in the legislature. It's a problem.
As I said in the car coming up, I always thought of him, what's the phrase? He may be a thug, but he's our thug. I felt he was on my side. And a friend of mine in New York said that she was still grateful to him for nixing the West Side Stadium. She lives on the Upper West Side, and would have been a disaster.
He also stopped the commuter tax, or was involved in the end of the commuter tax, which was hard on New York City, I think. That was a big loss during a very tight financial time.
Yeah, and so I think it certainly in the years, 20 years, in 1994 he became Speaker. He actually was first elected in 1976. You know, he has a record that he can be proud of as a legislator. At the same time, you say, what price did we pay as taxpayers?
What was the opportunity cost
of that money?
Mm-hmm. So you say, yes, he did good things, but do we want benevolent despots? Or do we want a process by which the people actually exercise some control? And if you think that progress is linear, well, you only get that linear progress if you have the benevolent despot, if the despot turns out to be benevolent in your terms.
Right.
But democracy doesn't move in a straight line.
Right.
There's ups and downs. Mm-hmm. And it gives everybody a chance, because if everybody doesn't buy in, then you have disaffected society, segments of society. And if they don't feel there's any place for them to be, then they take other means. And I'm not suggesting anything terribly dire, except when you look around the world, you see that there are places where people say, I can't get this any other way but by violence,
right. Mm-hmm.
but by,
or by
crime
graft or
graft.
Sort of, yeah.
And that undermines our system. And that's what I don't like about it. And that's what I felt depressed about, because I said, here was a guy who I genuinely thought, again, having had some dealings with Albany in wearing other hats, looking for nonprofit funding for libraries,
mm-hmm.
and things like
yeah.
that, you say, you know, well, he didn't have much use for that, although it wasn't hostile toward it, it wasn't a big priority. Well, am I going to hang him on that? I mean, am I going to be ungrateful for the other things? No. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that he was setting the priorities. And in fact, he was, the Speaker's power was such as he had accrued it, that he just determined, you know, who got what computers and who got what office space and who got what stationery,
mm-hmm.
and who got what assistance.
Staff,
I mean,
there's
who got to use the TV studio that the Assembly has, you know, that kind of stuff. To make videotapes for your constituency.
And how much money they got to run their
office
and serve their constituents.
And was Sheldon Silver the worst of the worst? No, I mean, and it's not even unclear what will happen in this trial. Certainly, the Joe Bruno trial is instructive.
Exactly.
So that, I mean, here was a man who was convicted, and then the Supreme Court made a determination that the law under which he was convicted was overreaching, and I tend to agree with that. I think it was a very broad law, and you got to be very careful that the federal government doesn't have more powers than it takes unto itself already. And then he had a second trial, I guess, and then there was a mistrial or whatever, and then finally he was acquitted when he was actually tried again.
And so, many people think that Silva will experience the same.
He may well do it. The Joe Bruno thing, when you think back about this horse and going places to see people and that kind of thing, it seems small compared to what Silva did,
right.
And it seemed like it was a moment of opportunity with a buddy, a crony type thing, which is not forgivable.
But he was also accused of involvement with pension funds.
Other things. So it's not clear what will happen in this case, but it is clear that the franchise, the brand of Sheldon Silver is seriously tarnished, and clearly he realized that, and clearly when the people in Albany, the caucus, when those folks read that complaint, that criminal complaint, they said, oh, wait a minute, this isn't just a Joe Bruno case. Look at this money. We can't justify it. My assumption is, and I have no inside knowledge whatsoever, is that they looked at it and said, if this guy walks free, it doesn't matter, because we can't tell our constituents it's okay to earn $600,000in a year, $800,000 I think in 1 year, but I may be off on the figures, but let's say $600,000 plus I know about for sure, in a year, just by sitting at a desk, and that's not taking advantage of your office.
Well, and it wasn't just sitting at the desk, was like funding this research that was then funneling people into the
firm. There was a quid pro quo. Yeah. It certainly seems that way.
He was also accused of mail fraud. Do you understand?
Well, I'm assuming that just has to do with the way that you communicate. Once you use certain, like the internet
or
whatever.
If you're committing a crime and you mail something to somebody, that's mail fraud.
Yeah, that's mail fraud. So that's just a technical.
They can't get them on anything else. They can get them on mail fraud.
Right, exactly, right. Yeah.
And they use the same thing with wire fraud. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. If you use email to commit the crime, then it's part of it. If you're just joining us, we're with Perry Teasdale, who's the publisher of the Columbia paper. Tell us a little bit about the Columbia paper before we move on. You've been now in business for quite some time.
Well, I think so. we're actually completing our sixth year, so we're going to, go on from there. And we started it from zero, and we built it into the second largest paid circulation in Columbia County. we continue to grow, not as much as I'd like, but we are a community newspaper, and our community is Columbia County. We tend to be what I call militantly parochial, in that our focus really remains on Columbia County, and we want it to be there because there's enough to talk about each week. You can get it on the newsstand, you can get it through the mail, and you can get parts of it online. Occasionally we do. And of course, you can see the editorial and the front page picture and a few other things on Facebook. And occasionally I get together to post to post on IMBY, the site that Enid Futterman and her co-conspirators have, I certainly recommend that, and I wish I were more energetic and got it done more regularly.
Well, it takes a lot to put out a newspaper.
It does take a lot. It takes a lot of people, and the people who are involved in it are marvelous, and it's been a real privilege to do it. I like group activities. And I have since Video Freaks. And,
Video Freaks.
That's right. It was a group of people.
Video Freaks, yes.
And I'm happy to say that this newspaper is a group effort, and every week it is, and it's something new every week, and that's fun, you know. That's the thing that keeps you going, keeps you energized, because there's always another story, there's always something mm-hmm. more happening, and I think the people of Columbia County deserve another voice to tell them what's going on.
Mm-hmm. So you skipped over Video Freaks, but you also have some news about an exhibition that is opening this weekend, this coming weekend?
The Samuel Dorsky Museum of Art in New Paltz has an exhibition that goes from February into the spring sometime, I guess the end of the school year, at the museum on the campus. I haven't seen it. It is an exhibition about Video Freaks and I'm going to say the history of guerrilla television, but I can't remember the exact title. It's really awful, but it's one of those things I haven't been able to focus on as much. Although we took a lot of things off our walls and at our home, and my wife Carol was also part of the group. There were 10 adults, and it started actually at the Woodstock Festival back in 1969. I was there with some video equipment that I had purchased a while back and was experimenting with it, and I met a guy there named David Court, and he had some even better equipment. That was the first portable video equipment that was available to consumers at a price that was affordable. Television before then had been really the sole province of networks and large television stations, right. Or television stations by definition are large enterprises, and we were able to shoot tape not of the festival music, but of what was going on at the around where the hog farm was and where the medical tents were, and just get a sense of the people who were there. Anyway, we took that back to David's loft in New York. He was living with Mary Curtis Radcliffe, and the three of us worked together to edit these tapes and to make other tapes, and somebody said, hey, this is a word that you could use to describe your group, and it was Video Freaks, F-R-E-E-X, mm-hmm. all one word, and at that time there were other people in New York beginning to experiment. We actually made connections with an executive at CBS, and he had some money, and we were happy to take it to develop a presentation for a pilot for the CBS network, and we traveled to Chicago and taped Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin and the people who were on trial in the Chicago 8 that became the Chicago 7 trial. And one of the interviews that we did in Chicago was with a guy named Fred Hampton, who was the chairman of the Black Panther Party in right. Chicago. And I interviewed him, and I asked him at one point, what happens if you die? What happens if you're killed? Because other Black Panthers had been killed. And he gave me an interesting explanation that the party would go on. It wasn't built around individuals. And he was a mesmerizing speaker, actually, just my age. And I was young. Mm-hmm. And after that, we went out to California, and we shot tape there, and we shot some of the tape in New York, edited it all together. We were up actually in Greene County, in East Durham, and we were editing, and the news came that Fred Hampton had been shot in his bed, and ultimately he was killed at that time, along with someone else, another member of the party, by the Chicago police. And I believe that the family actually got a civil judgment of murder in the case, but mm-hmm. of course nobody was going to say the police were guilty. Right. This was a year after the Chicago police riots in 68 mm-hmm. at the Democratic Convention.
Right.
But it was it kind of lent a seriousness. But over the tape, I had a confrontation with the guy from CBS, and he wanted to put some CBS News footage with our footage of the interview that was of the funeral. And it was just film transferred to videotape with some music in the background and maybe one of their people. And we said, no. I said, mm-hmm. There won't be a show if you do this. Well, we did a show for the CBS executives in a loft in a place down in southern Manhattan, lower Manhattan. And the executives were not impressed. And the guy who was the head of programming for CBS at the time came out from a separate room where he was viewing this in the, near the loft, and he said, "Well, you people are 5 years away from being on network television," and he was right to the year. Actually, we thought he was very condescending. But in any case, we went out on our own and made tapes in New York City, and then what happened was there was some funding from the state. We managed to get some of it as the State Arts Council grew in its budget back in the early 1970s, and we moved to a place called Lanesville. In the mountaintop, right outside of Hunter, Tannersville. Yep. And we were living in an old boarding house, and we set up our studio there, and there were still 10 adults at that point. We had some attrition shortly thereafter, but basically we had people coming and visiting us, and we would go out all around the state and train people how to use videotape. And during the process, we were making a lot of tapes. We always were making tapes. And the net result of that was that we had a lot of tapes, and in the city we'd had shows. We'd bring people; they'd walk five floors up in a loft in a place called Soho. Who knew it was Soho? A cop in the street stopped me and said, "Hey, you know what they call this place?" I said, "No." He said, "Oh, it's Soho, south of Houston. How about that, huh?" Well, okay. You know, I had no idea what Soho. But then it became quickly too expensive, which is why we moved to the country, and. In any case, we had no way to show it. But while we were in the city, Abby Hoffman had asked me to write, to do some research and write up a draft of how you would do broadcast television if you were going to do it as a pirate thing. And I didn't know how to do that. I mean, I had to go steal a book to do it. But he was writing a book called Steal This Book.
Right.
And he... I sent it. I gave it to him, and instead of paying us in cash and paying the group, he bought us a piece of equipment we thought we needed to broadcast. But it really didn't do the full job. It took a little bit longer. But in Lanesville, we had a breather basically, and a real need to get this signal out. And this was before the days of cable television, and even now, I don't know whether there's cable television in Lanesville. It's so sparsely populated.
Yeah.
So. Along with the engineer that we had who was working with us and part of the group, we developed a broadcast transmitter from this equipment and from the equipment that we had and got Lanesville TV on the air. And so for 5 years, once a week or twice a week, depending on early on it was more, but we did regular broadcasts over the air without a television station license. In the little community of Lanesville. And we used that as a model to show how it could be done other places, and then cable was starting to develop in cities.
Now they'd squash you like a bug, but...
Not necessarily. They don't have the resources to do it, but one of the people had been... You have to annoy people to get them to complain.
Right.
And one of the things that we did was we always had a live phone line. Every program, didn't matter what it was, you could call in. Now, you wouldn't, if we were running a tape sequence, you had to wait till the tape sequence was over, but we always had the number on the bottom of the screen. People would call up and they'd say, "Oh, my signal isn't good," or "Can you turn the antenna a little bit?" "Oh, just a minute, we'll do that." So you're adjusting it while it's going on. While the show is, there was all kind of out front. And we had some people who complained, and one evening, the woman who picked up our garbage called and said, "I want to watch All in the Family, and you're interfering with it," because the TV came in over the mountain. We said, "Okay, well, if anybody wants this programming to continue, call in." Nobody called in, so we turned off the transmitter. It was that response.
Right.
And what it said to people was, "Hey, this is your station as well as their station.
Right.
It's not mysterious. You can walk in and see what's going on," and we encourage that. They saw us on the street. They saw us at the post office. We were part of the community, even though they called us the videos. They couldn't say the word freaks.
Were you well received?
Well, after a while. Yeah, it took a while to have that happen. But anyway, it was really a community medium, and... So we never had any complaints filed. And when the FBI came to spy on us, and they did a couple of times, one of the people agents who checked us out, it turned out was his last assignment before he retired. He lived in the Tannersville area, and he became the town supervisor. And then he told us about the fact that he had been the agent to spy. So I had a chance to interview the guy, the spy, who spied on us.
The spy who spied me.
Yeah, exactly. and it was great, and he was a good guy. He was a good supervisor, and then he became the principal of the high school, and he was just an interesting man. Anyway, but to go back to the point of this was the community station. When the FBI, another agent of the FBI came later to spy on us for different reasons, apparently, that his report said, because I got through the Freedom of Information Law, the Federal Freedom of Information Act, they're very polite, and they are broadcasting on a local TV station. It never occurred to the FBI the only thing we were doing that was wrong was broadcasting on a local frequency.
Right.
And the rest of it, they were looking for, actually, apparently that second time, they were looking for Patty Hearst, or at least they said they were. And I thought they were, I thought that was really a stretch.
Yeah.
But it turns out that Patty Hearst was held in Southern, or she was living with the Symbionese Liberation Army,
right.
Or you can determine for yourself what the circumstances were, in Sullivan County. I don't know exactly what part of it. And so it wasn't so far-fetched that they were looking for there.
If you're just joining us, we're with Parry Teasdale, who's the editor, the publisher of the Columbia paper, and also a founding member of Video Freaks, and that's what we've been talking about just now.
Kind of got off the topic.
Just remind the listeners about the show, just before we move on. We'll move back to about the exhibition this weekend.
Oh, well, the exhibition is artifacts and tapes from the period in both New York and in Lanesville, and it just tries to put us in context because there was a lot of other activity. I want to make it real clear that we were not the only people doing video.
Right.
But now look at where we are. Back then, equipment was almost unavailable until this new Sony stuff and then other manufacturers came along to bring out these notebook size, cameras and portable recorders. And it was totally the province of three networks, and that was the only way you could get a signal out, basically,
right.
is going through one of those.
There was no YouTube.
And now, what have you got? You've got multiple networks, and everybody who's got a smartphone has video production capability,
right.
mm-hmm. and apparently, 300 hours are being uploaded every minute to YouTube. 300
Holy
hours of
cow.
New video. So there's so much that nobody can find anything. And
no.
so the networks are clinging on to their lead as part of the as aggregators of the audience or of having a focus at one time. But it's diminished. I mean, if you look at how it is now compared to how it
right.
was then, there was no competition.
The only thing everybody's watching is the Super Bowl, apparently.
Yeah.
And two-thirds
and
of the population didn't.
Yeah.
It's even hard to make a career in journalism these days thanks to all this amateur news that's being...
Well, yeah, it's a shakeout, it's a change. It was the video that we were working with was a disruptive technology, and it still is. But now it's combined with the web, so that there's 300 hours of every minute of new cat video and whatever. And so there's going to be some sort of winnowing of that in some way. But probably not the way we think,
right.
because what we did didn't play out in the way we thought. Because
right.
I ended up doing some consulting work for the Federal Communications Commission to try to make stations like Lanesville legal, and they are legal now, and there's one sitting in the corner of this building, and it actually broadcasts it broadcasts a signal from Schenectady to off of the mountain in Woodstock. But the problem is that the value anymore of low-power TV stations is not the programming, because anybody can get YouTube and they
right.
can get cable and right. they can get satellite. That's not the value anymore. And digital, you can stack multiple channels on each frequency.
Right.
The value is in the frequency itself. And so if you can do mobile communications, then that's where the money is.
Right.
So the FCC... auctions off our natural resources, and part of our natural resources are, in the case of the FCC, is the radio waves.
And much like the radio wave that we are broadcasting
exactly.
on right
exactly.
now.
Yeah. Yeah. They didn't do, when they did TV, they wouldn't do radio at first. It took years to get
right.
radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So let's go back to our original topic. Could you envision this going as high as the governor?
You mean a scandal?
Yeah.
Well, I think the first thing they're going to have to do is to make sure that they've got the right guy in Carl Hastie.
Right.
He's the assemblyman from the 83rd District and the Bronx community, the Bronx County Democratic leader.
Right.
And he comes with some baggage. He was looked at by the Moreland Commission, and that was the commission that Governor Cuomo set up and then abruptly stopped and disbanded. And that led to the federal prosecutor taking over the records of the investigation. And apparently the Moreland Commission had looked into Mr. Hastie's reimbursements or requests for reimbursements and some of his undocumented spending.
Right.
Not on the level of Sheldon Silver, certainly, at least as far as we know. And apparently the word is consistently that the federal prosecutor has shown no interest in Mr. Hastie in terms of what the Moreland Commission found. Mm-hmm. You'd suspect that might be revisited now that he's the speaker,
right?
But maybe not. You know, and I do not want to in any way accuse this guy of doing something wrong. I'm not here to say that. I hope he's successful. That would be
right.
good. It does mark a step forward in terms of diversity at the top, and that will be good. I think that's an unalloyed good in the sense of what it represents. But whether the fact that they acted so precipitously, even though you have to give them credit for understanding that if they waited, it's only going to get worse.
Mm-hmm.
They had to pick a speaker.
Right.
You can't have in this time of year, especially, no speaker. And what's happening is, all the jockeying for position, and there's some talk that Mr. Hastie and the governor are much closer than the speaker and the governor. Well, the governor is basically...
Sheldon Silver.
And so the governor is going to, in any case, come out much more powerful from all of this at this moment. Now, whether there's an issue about him shutting the commission down, I think that's a dicey proposition for any prosecutor, because governors have extraordinary power.
Mm-hmm.
And he did get an ethics law, a weak and ineffectual ethics law,
right.
without disclosure. And so I think you can say fairly that from a historical standpoint, perhaps, it isn't gonna look very good for him. But I think he made a calculation that the public just didn't care. And I think based on what's been going on over the years, that wasn't an unreasonable calculation to make. If you wanted to do stuff, you should be, I think he said, let's go for the big things we can get. And some of the big things he did get. Same-sex marriage in his first term, the SAFE Act. You can go down the list of and pushing for a higher minimum wage, pushing for a women's...
A lot of people would say that it was not a legitimate push. I mean,
the things he did get passed were legitimate, and a lot of people upstate, especially, liked the tax cap,
right?
But a majority of New Yorkers who
right.
don't live upstate. They like it, and it's a very popular.
You probably saw that this week he's calling for additional. He threw it to the legislature to have stronger ethics law.
Yeah, well, he's saying that. Well, the interesting thing about that was that was in the speech at
at
New York
Law
School, on Friday, I guess, or Saturday, whatever. But he said that he wasn't going to sign the budget. There would be a late budget,
right,
basically,
right.
If he doesn't get this. So he's already, he's saying, I'm in charge right now.
Right.
And so far he is, because the cloud is hanging over Dean Skelos, the head of the Senate,
mm-hmm.
the leader of the Senate. And so he is, even though he has not been charged with any crime, they said the NBC TV station in New York said that he was being investigated by Preet Bharara's office,
who's the federal prosecutor in the Southern District.
So he's been looking into it. But the Skilis people came back and said, well, this is very thinly sourced. And it was. It was the people familiar with. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, but regardless, once you raise the specter, it weakens Skilos to a certain degree. Because then people are shy because of the silver thing.
Right.
So it makes the governor the key player. And regardless of his relationship with Hasty, he doesn't have to have a particular relationship with the guy because he comes in with this cloud over his head about just his own behavior in terms of financial stuff, not because it's a crime, but because, do we want
another
this?
Another
sloppy guy, and a guy who has a background in finance and statistics, and so you say, well, wait a minute, what are we talking about here? But so that's difficult. But it explained maybe something that came up at the Hudson City School District last week, and it'll be reported just briefly. In our issue coming out this Thursday, which is that this district says that at first they received information that they should develop a wish list for this year's budget. Now, remember, there's a $5 billion, some people call it a surplus. Really, I think Tom DiNapoli, this controller of the state, is much more correct to call it a windfall, because what it is the money from the money that the financial institutions paid in terms of fines. It's New York's share.
Mm-hmm.
But leaving that aside for a moment, they were told to produce a wish list, and now they're being told make it as if there's going to be a freeze on funding. Now, a freeze on funding would mean there's basically a continuation of the budget if the budget isn't passed.
Right.
So I think that may be a ploy to put fear into the school districts that they won't get, there won't be any increase in the budget. They'll be locked in deadlock, mm-hmm. and that's a very difficult position for schools to be in because they can't do anything. That may be just saying that. Who knows what kind of a trial balloon that is, mm-hmm. and where it came from? They didn't say where it came from,
right.
But I think we're trying to explore that a little bit and see what we can find. It's an interesting time because Albany is very unsettled. So back to your original question, this is going to reach to the governor. My sense of it is right now, from what we know, and that's not much, that it would be a hard case to make against a sitting governor if he's not enriched himself with that. So if he's been inquiring and saying, well, we don't want you to do this job on these people, which is smarmy, perhaps, but is it an interference in judicial or in prosecutorial conduct? I don't know. I think
right.
that's something that may be a technicality, but I'm not sure that the people of New York really want that kind of interference with their government, since they didn't even care about the rest of it. They keep.
Right.
Yeah, for instance, let me just take a step back. How much do people not care? Well, what do you think the margin of victory for Carl Hasty, the new speaker in half an hour, what do you think I guess it's a half an hour or so, what do you think the margin of victory was of his last race? Take a guess. How many, what percentage of the vote did he get in his district?
5%?
Carl Hasty. He is the speaker
right.
of the assembly.
75%.
He ran for office in the last
election.
Yeah. How much of the vote did he get?
Well, I know the turnout in that district is very bad.
Very bad.
But I have no idea what the percentages tell us.
How does 96%?
Right.
Yeah.
That's
did he
have an opponent?
Yeah.
And that's down from 97,
right.
according to Ballotopia.
Wow.
Now,
right.
I don't have the state, but it's a
right.
it's a really good website
wow.
About all sorts of candidates everywhere, and it really it's an excellent source.
One of his newly elected colleagues, also from the Bronx, Michael Blake, said it's a transformational moment, and the Times Union said it could be a watershed. It could turn out to be. Do you think there's any chance of that, or do you think Albany will just go back to business as usual?
It can't be the same way, because somebody who's had the power as long as Sheldon Silver has had, and who manipulated it in the way that he did, I think it may be a watershed moment, but I think it could be a chaotic moment for a while. I think it's going to be very troubled, because what you have is, you know, remember, it's 150 people in the assembly, and 106 of them are Democrats. And so 44 are Republicans. So the Democrats control everything, and they also the Speaker, basically, because he controls supposedly the Democratic caucus, and so far Hastie does, because they're all behind him now. There's no dissident faction at this point. They control education law, basically. They control the education department. The governor does not control that. The governor does not appoint the Board of Regents. The governor does not appoint the Commissioner of Education. That's done by the legislature. But when you say the legislature, when you add the Democrats in the assembly to the Democrats, and it's a very close situation in the Senate, the whole legislature gets the vote on these, the Democrats have control over education. Which is where the money goes in New York State. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's the power, basically. That's the biggest power, but not certainly the only one that the Speaker exercises. And that's the one that gets everybody's attention, frankly, here, everywhere.
Yes.
Because schools, it's either upstate, it's schools taxes as well as educational policy. In the city, it's educational policy and school funding for the actual school buildings, because the property tax is not a big deal, especially for homeowners in New York City. It's because the tax base is so large, the individual taxes from properties are small. And there's a city income tax, which is much more progressive. So, you have a statewide consensus that education matters.
Well, because the kids. It's always
well,
about
but
the
no,
kids,
but it's the kids and it's my tax.
Right, of course,
it's my tax bill too. So that upstate you have that, and on Long Island.
Yeah.
See, that's the one place where the Long Island may be different from the city. In a lot of cases, the sensibilities are the same.
Right.
But in schools, it's different, and so there's a tremendous power. So is it a watershed? I don't know. I mean, certainly it'll test Mr. Hastie's abilities as a leader, because he's got to keep Manhattan together with Staten Island, together with Bronx and Brooklyn. I mean, Bronx he controls, okay? He knows where all the strings are there. But what does he do with Queens, where he's already basically managed to push out
standing was Kathy Nolan.
So she, you know... was not, you know, she agreed to go along with it and now supports him, and good for her.
Because she didn't have the numbers.
Has Hastie been in office a long time? So he's got a lot of
2000, I think, I believe, and I want to be very careful. Again, I don't want to set myself up as an expert in this area, because I don't go to Albany and I don't cover these things on a regular basis. I have this kind of distant view of it, and I try to stay informed. But
and even if you had a reporter in Albany, it'd be very, very hard to
cover it.
A columnist who writes for the Times Union said, I try to go at it as an average Joe. He has a column on Sundays. I think his name might be Seiler.
Casey Seiler, he's an editor. He's an important editor.
He said, I have to, be an insider to get this, these inside comments so I can find out what's going on. It's very hard, just like going to the Board of Supervisors this year, to actually understand what's going on if you're there watching.
So we're going to have to wrap it up. We've been with Perry Teasdale, who's the publisher. I should keep doing that. The publisher of the Columbia Paper.
Well, I'm also the editor.
Oh, the editor. All right. Okay. Yeah. So, but do you have any last thoughts before we wrap it up?
Last thoughts? No. I hope people listen and think and pay attention to their state government, because it's in a costly endeavor. It's an essential part of our democracy, and We can control it. We have, I think, honest people. In fact, I'm sure that the people who represent the county are honest people. The question is, what kind of influence will their behavior have on the rest of the their colleagues? And I hope it's a good influence now. These things tend to come and go, you know.
Right.
They don't last very long. There's too many temptations. But I think the place to start is with full disclosure for every dollar that every lawmaker earns. I think that's the price you pay for the power and the prestige and the whatever it is, the amusement value of, mm-hmm. of being a lawmaker, that you should have to disclose every penny you make. And there's just no way around it. And if you don't want to do that, then don't go into public office. Don't
right.
go into that particular office. That's it.
We'll have to leave it there. This has been At Issue. I'm Victor Mandolia.
I'm Deborah Gilbert.
I'm Debbie Mayer.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks on At Issue on WGXE 90.7 FM. ACRA, Catskill Hudson.